Hi, everybody. Hal Eisner here. Welcome to another episode of What the Hal. This week we're talking about cigarette smoking. And we're talking about cigarette smoking because over the last three decades, it's really declined dramatically. So much so that you have cities like Beverly Hills that are talking about curbing it and banning it completely, making Beverly Hills a smoke-free city. We're going to talk about that. And we had the son of a well-known celebrity, a famous actor, who died because of lung cancer. Let me just start off by having you guys introduce yourselves. Ethan, why don't you start?
My name is Ethan Wayne. I'm John Wayne's youngest son. I run John Wayne Enterprises and the John Wayne Cancer Foundation.
I'm Keith Sterling. I'm the public information manager and spokesman for the city of Beverly Hills.
And that may seem like two very different sort of things, but the fact of the matter is they have an awful lot in common. Beverly Hills is in the process of looking at how to continually restrict down the ability for people to smoke within the city limits of Beverly Hills. And Ethan's life has really been about anti-smoking. Dad passed away years ago because of lung cancer, and we're going to get into all of that. But I guess I do want to start off by just having you, Ethan, explain what your foundation does and how it works and how people can get involved.
Sure. I'd love to. The John Wayne Cancer Foundation, our main programs are research, education, awareness, and support. So on the research side, we have a surgical oncology fellowship program, so new surgeons will come out of their general surgical training, and they can either go into private practice or they'll come to an accredited facility like John Wayne to learn how to become specialists in brain, breast, melanoma, neuro, and GI or urology. So they'll do 2 years with us, and then they'll go out and be really top of the charts in their fields. And we have graduated 155 fellows to date. At the Cancer Foundation, we've connected all those fellows and given them other opportunities, like research grants. We do a number of research grants every year to that alumni fellow network. We'll support symposiums or meetings where they can share their information. All our grants are peer-reviewed by the Society of Surgical Oncology. We also have the John Wayne Cancer Institute, which resides here in Santa Monica, and they have a number of research programs. You know, if you've heard of immunotherapy, that came from there. If you've heard of the sentinel node biopsy technique, that was developed at John Wayne. That's a standard of care now for melanoma and breast. John Wayne has a very significant track record in the fight against cancer. And, you know, every paper that gets published by one of these guys is another little piece of the puzzle. So we work hard to make sure that if there is some information that's found out by one of our fellows, that we work hard to get it out there in front of everybody so that everybody can start putting this puzzle together.
One of the things I think is kind of interesting is it goes back to your dad. Because your dad, once he learned that he had incurable lung cancer, he wanted a strong effort to fight the disease.
He did.
Took him down.
You know, he had lung cancer in the early 60s, and he lived another 17 years, essentially my entire life, surviving that initial bout with lung cancer. And it came back in his stomach and metastasized in many places. And he let them try some unique therapies on him, and unfortunately none of them worked. But as he was, you know, fading, he said, use my name and do whatever you can do to help these doctors fight cancer. And so this started with my brother Michael and my brother Patrick and now myself and a great doctor named Donald Morton, who just passed, really led our family down the road of how to be effective in this fight against cancer.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, not every family is consumed with a particular disease that becomes the core of their life, but that's been the case with you.
It has, and the family really gets behind it, and there are a number of ways that people can get involved with us if they want to support. We are a recognized member of the Orange County Marathon, so you can join the Orange County Marathon and raise money for the John Wayne Cancer Foundation. That's the beginning of May. In June, my sister and her spin studios have a terrific event called the Gritty Up, which is a evening cocktail party and then a 3-hour spin ride. The next day, they've raised almost $1 million, over $1 million now in the last 3 years. It's a terrific event. And then we're going to be hosting a number of runs. The first one will be in October in Lone Pine, California, in the Alabama Hills, where a lot of these great Westerns were filmed. If you're an outdoors person, I don't think you can find a more spectacular or beautiful place to run on the trails. So we'll be having a half marathon up there first week of October.
And so I want to talk about your dad.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up to your dad. I went to his movies. I gathered the, what did you call that event, the Gritty Up?
The Gritty Up,
I gather that came from True Grit.
Yep.
And that was like my favorite John Wayne movie.
Great movie. And a great event. And a great guy.
Yeah, talk about the guy.
Well, I came along late. So, I'm sorry my brother Patrick or my sister Melinda aren't here to give you some background on him before I came along. But my life with him was pretty idyllic. If you're an outdoors type person, you know, growing up, going to location for 3 months of the year in Durango, Mexico, or Santa Fe, or Colorado, and being with the actors and the stuntmen and the wranglers, it was a great way of life. I don't think it was as fancy as movie sets are today. It was a real team effort, a real community that got out there early and went to work, and everybody was expected to carry their own weight, and if they didn't, you'd hear about it. Even as a child being on the set, I didn't know where the sight lines were and where the sound equipment was and where the lights were, and to stay the hell out of everybody's way.
You mean stay the hell?
Stay the hell out of everybody's way, sure.
What the hell, right?
You know, it's good when you're young and you're exposed to things like that where you have to be somewhat responsible and your mind has to be engaged and you have to have some awareness of what's going on around you. I think it helps. It helps kids.
It may be hard to remember back because you were little, but when your dad got cancer, mm-hmm. and it came back metastasizing his stomach, this was pretty big. He was advertising commercials for cigarettes, and then all of a sudden he was doing commercials not to smoke.
Right. And I'm not sure in his mind if he loved smoking. And I don't know. I'd have to ask my brother and my sister if he really accepted the fact that his illness was related to the smoking or possibly the nuclear testing out in Nevada when he was filming a movie called The Conqueror.
He had some thought in his mind that it might have been that.
Well, everyone on that film set has died of cancer, and they were, exposed to high levels of radiation. In fact, some of the dirt that they brought back to the studio lot to do pickup scenes was tested years and years later, and it was still highly radioactive earth.
Really?
So I don't think anything was ever proven, but I think in my father's mind, he was very romantic about chewing tobacco, cigars, and cigarettes.
He was a chain smoker.
And he gave it up after lung cancer. You know, obviously, my family doesn't have the physiology to smoke. And once my father passed, years later, my sister Tony, who was also a smoker, got lung cancer and succumbed to the disease. And my sister Melinda has had a lung transplant. And, I think it's related to smoking. And I think, there are people who've lived many years as smokers and drinkers, but as a rule of thumb, I think we now know that smoking is full of carcinogens and it is not a healthy habit. And probably the worst thing about smoking, is that if you're smoking, you're affecting the people that are around you who may not be smokers. So I'm not a smoker, but, if Beverly Hills wants to ban cigarettes, I'm all for it. I love it. I'm sure some people will feel like they're, the city may be overreaching into their civil liberties, but those people are affecting others in a negative way by smoking. So how do we find a way to protect?
Well, I think you just came up with the first question for Keith.
I have to follow. I have to follow
Sorry.
Ethan now
Sorry,
with
Keith.
All these stories.
Sorry,
I have
Keith.
To follow this.
Yeah, and so What is Beverly Hills doing, trying to do, hoping to accomplish?
Well, our council, led by our mayor and vice mayor primarily, have been talking about or exploring the idea of banning tobacco citywide. Right now, there are already restrictions in place in Beverly Hills. So when folks come to our city, if they do wish to smoke, we require that they do it as they're traveling, as they're walking.
So they have to keep moving.
They have to keep
moving. So you can't just stand still. You know, it used to be a time that you'd be inside and you go, oh, I'd like to have a cigarette. I'm going to go step outside. Of course, that's after the restaurant bans and everything else, because you used to be able to smoke inside too. So you'd go outside and you'd have your cigarette and you'd go back inside. Now you go outside, you got to walk in a circle or something because you can't stand still. It's not okay.
That's exactly right.
It's against the law.
And we have what we call our ambassadors out there to educate people.
People in green shirts.
People in green shirts to let them know that this is the law. But, you know, one of the things that I think the council has been very vocal about is making sure that we still let folks feel welcome in our city and not feel ostracized that they can't be here and enjoy themselves.
That was the point Ethan was making. I mean, where's that slippery slope?
Right.
I mean, how do you sort of tell people, we want you to enjoy your time here. By the way, don't pull out a cigarette.
Right.
Don't smoke it. Don't light it up. Don't go to our parks and inhale. Don't even stand still. You got to keep walking if you're going to have a cigarette lit. How do you balance that?
Yeah, it's a new way of thinking. But as you pointed out earlier, you know, 30 years ago, the thought of not smoking in a restaurant was a foreign concept. Now it's absolutely the norm. So I think in some ways our council likes to think that we can be a leader because we do have a national aim, an international aim, really, and that this could be leading by example.
Have you guys talked at all about what, like, has been proposed in Hawaii, the idea of putting an almost unreachable age on the ability to smoke? There it's 100.
Yeah, I think it's early in the process. The next few months are going to be key for the council and the mayor to decide how they wish to move forward, and that's going to involve a lot of public input. And we know we're going to hear from our hotels, our restaurants, not to mention our citizens who have strong feelings about this.
One way or the other. Just to sort of elaborate on that Hawaii thing, Ethan, what they're talking about there is gradually rolling in an age limit on smoking. So here we have age limits. What is it, 21? You can't buy a pack of cigarettes unless you're 21. Hmm. I've been 21 so many times I can't remember when I was 21. But the thing is that in Hawaii they're talking about making it 100. So until you're 100, I guess that means you have to show your driver's license when you're 100 if you want to get a cigarette to put on your birthday cake. But that seems so almost... It's almost laughable, but then maybe that's what it's come to.
It's a tough one, and you know, but it's an interesting choice for you guys. You know, we're going to hear a lot from both sides. I, as a non-smoker, love it. I'd love, you know, I've been in a non-smoking area for so long. If somebody's smoking in a car, you know, two or three cars in front of me, I can smell it while we're driving. You know, it's very noticeable. But when you're a smoker, I'm sure you want to keep smoking.
Well, when you're a smoker, I don't think you notice it.
No, I don't think you notice it.
But when you quit smoking,
oh boy,
you can get it a mile away.
Yeah.
I mean, the cigarette has such an acrid smell to it that you can't get away from it. But so right now there are many restrictions in the city of Beverly Hills. The most recent was on apartment buildings. You can't smoke in multi-unit apartment buildings.
Correct.
That's or condos that you buy.
That's right.
It's no good anymore. Is that marijuana also?
Yes.
Because in state law, you can smoke marijuana in your home, your apartment.
Yes, it's marijuana as well.
So it's banned there. Mm-hmm. Is the sale banned there also, marijuana?
For medical use only.
Medical use only.
Yes, yes.
And so going forward, public hearings, conversation with the community, but this is kind of not on necessarily a fast track, but it's on a track.
It's on a track. I think some of our elected officials, our vice mayor in particular, has expressed that he would like it on a fast track, but I think just the nature of the public process and the amount of input that we're going to be receiving, it's probably going to take a while.
What do you think the impression is going to be if around the world Beverly Hills is known as a smoke-free city?
I think it depends who you ask.
Well, I guess so, but I mean, seriously, what's another smoke-free city?
Isn't Calabasas completely
smoke-free? They have restrictions. They have restrictions.
Because my understanding is that we would be the first city to to be completely tobacco-free.
Wow.
I think in the country and possibly the world, but I don't know.
I gather that's true. But it's also, it's not just where you can smoke, it's even selling it. Mm. And I'm not sure if in Calabasas they have any kind of restrictions on sales. And a lot of the restrictions that are in place now, like in Beverly Hills, are about flavored things because there's a feeling that young people who are vaping will use cherry-flavored whatever and watermelon-flavored whatever to smoke.
Sure.
And so if you get the flavors out of there, you get rid of an issue. But menthol cigarettes is considered a flavor, and yet menthol's been around since your dad.
Yeah, long time.
Did he smoke menthol?
No, he smoked unfiltered Camel Straights.
Wow.
Yeah, he'd light one in the morning, and he'd light the other one off the one that he was currently smoking.
And so on and so on. So, I mean, there's a lot of movement here. And so one of the things you and I talked about, Ethan, was when we first started talking about getting together, was the idea of if we were in an airplane looking down at 30,000 feet, what would we be able to learn from what's happened over these last three decades with regard to smoking?
Well, if you think back, or if you've spent any time in Europe, as a non-smoker, it's very difficult to go live in that environment. So once you're past that, you're very happy that it's a non-smoking environment. The slope is how much do we want our government telling us what to do?
I think that's a fundamentally important question.
I'm all for non-smoking, but I like to have my freedoms as well.
Well, I think the number was in 1964, if I remember correctly. There were almost half of the country was smoking. Is that what the statistic was I had earlier?
I mean, I think in the 90s, I flew to Europe in a plane, and the row in front of me is smoking, and I'm in the non-smoking row.
Yeah. So here in 1964, 42% or nearly half of all Americans smoked. That's a powerful statistic,
yep.
And even more powerful is that now that number is about 15%.
Wow, dramatic. What's shocking to me is, we don't see cigarette ads. We're non-smoking in restaurants in many, many places. But if you watch a film or a television show, I mean, they're smoking like crazy in every production that I look at. So is that where the tobacco industry spends their money to get in front of people? Is it film production and television?
I mean, product placement has always been a big deal in Hollywood, whether it's a soda or something else.
But, you watch films, and you got to watch people smoking through the entire film. And I get it. Like, some people smoke, but not that many people smoke.
I got to tell you a story. When I was a kid, most of my life has been in broadcasting. But when I was a kid, I think I was 15, my very, 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 very first job, I was an usher at a theater in Dallas. It was one of those General Cinema twin theaters. And they had a loge. Hi. They had a loge, and it was just a smoking section. And then they had the rest of the general admission audience. And I was in like an orange tuxedo with a flashlight, and I would walk people down the aisle, and if they wanted to smoke, I'd direct them to the left side of the theater, and if they didn't want to smoke, I'd direct them to the right side of the theater. Boy, are we a long way from that.
Yeah.
We are a long way from that.
Yeah.
Smoking in restaurants and theaters and anything. I don't think we smoke anywhere anymore in enclosed areas.
Well, look, we know it's bad for you, and we know it's not only bad for the smoker, but it's horrible for the people who are getting the secondhand smoke, right? So, now you're opening it up to people like my family. We don't have great genetics for tobacco, right? Father had lung cancer, sister died of lung cancer, other sister has a lung transplant. I know that I shouldn't smoke. So if I'm sitting next to somebody and I'm breathing that smoke, I know that it's not good for me. And then, through the news and all the other information that's come out, we know that what they put in cigarettes is highly addictive. We know they put carcinogens in there that are horrible for us. And then I look at the butts. The butts are all over the street. They go into the drains. They go into the, sewage water, and they end up someplace. And, a dog or an animal or somebody like that's chewing on a cigarette butt getting poisoned. So, yeah, it's
tough.
Well,
that is certainly the global look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, one little cigarette can touch an awful lot of creatures.
I think what our elected officials have talked about, too, is the changing behavior and attitudes that come with, a change in policy or new direction. I mean, look at cell phones. 20 years ago, whatever it was cool to be on the phone in the car. Now, it's against the law. And so evolving views and evolving attitudes, I think, is key here.
Yeah, I mean, societal changes are constant. We're always changing something. And so this is certainly a case in point. I think that smoking in particular is a really interesting barometer of societal change. You know, I can go back to 1987 when the restaurants in Beverly Hills were doing what they could to abide by local government standards of getting rid of smoking inside. And, you know, they'd have – it was funny because they had signs that would say in the outdoor area, you can smoke and eat out here. You know, they would label it in a way that you knew it was okay to smoke because they didn't want to lose a dollar. And so, you know, now we're in a very reverse situation where the city has gone about the business of putting all kinds of smoking restrictions in place, but there are no signs. And we've talked about this, Keith. We talked about the idea that anybody that comes to your city can't possibly even know unless they heard this podcast or watched my television show or read something somewhere that you have these sort of restrictions in Beverly Hills. But you're now changing that.
That is changing.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so there's going to be an extensive signage campaign rolled out over the next few months, this year for sure. By the end of the year, I think it'll be very clear when you walk through Beverly Hills that we're a non-smoking city. We're talking about the gateways, the heavy pedestrian areas. And you're right. To this point, we haven't done an extensive signage.
It doesn't look like you've owned it.
Right. And I think some of that was intentional in the sense that we want to – it's very important that we keep that welcoming environment in our city. And if everything you see when you walk in the city is a bunch of signs with big red X's – that's not exactly
what. But you know what? Just like other signs you have, you could do a really classy job. I mean, you have a nice little job on Rodeo Drive, and
and that's what we're working on.
And so, what do you think your signs are going to look like?
Well, we've seen a few concepts actually just this week. You've got the classic Beverly Hills shield with some script writing that says "Smoke Free Community," "Your Health First," those types of things. So, we'll look at it and get it rolled out soon.
Sounds interesting. All right. Well, let me give you both sort of a final thought here on what you'd like to leave everybody with regard first to smoking and then secondly with regard to your city or organizations. And let me start with Keith.
Yeah, we got to close strong, so let me go first.
Nah.
I know my place. No, I think I would just say for folks that are interested to stay tuned and watch over the next few months as Beverly Hills examines this issue. BeverlyHills.org, our website, will be the kind of central point for regular updates and information. There'll be public hearings. There'll be public surveys and input to hear from folks about this issue. And ultimately, again, it's what our mayor has talked about is the health. It's about health, and Ethan's done a great job, of course, of talking so personally about that we want to promote a healthy city. And so, but at the same time, we recognize that we have businesses and we have visitors, and they all have their own personal interests as well. So it's finding that balance, and the council's going to do their best to do that.
All right. Ethan?
I think it's great. You know, you're hopefully you'll help some people quit a terrible disease that costs them financially and physically. And hopefully we'll get the people who are converting to non-smoking to come over and do one of our outside athletic endeavors at the Cancer Foundation, help us raise some money to help the people who, you know, are battling the disease, whether it be lung, brain, breast, melanoma. I mean, cancer is a very difficult disease, and it's nice to be able to give some support and hopefully find a cure.
One of the things that they give out, these ambassadors that Keith was talking about, is instead of some kind of a citation and a fine for breaking the law, they give you this little card. And on one side it says, breathe healthy, be healthy, smoking, vaping, not allowed in Beverly Hills public spaces. On the back, it gives you a phone number and a website to quit and how you can find ways to quit. And so I guess, you know, I'd like to know, do you guys at the foundation have suggestions like that?
We don't. We haven't really focused on smoking. You know, we focus on training the surgeons to become specialists. We focus on supporting their research. We focus on getting them in front of people at gatherings and symposiums, whether it be the World Cancer Congress. It's held different times all over the world. We'll make sure that our guys and the papers that get published are there. We're working on a grit ranch for John Wayne.
A grit ranch?
A grit ranch.
A true grit ranch?
It'll be a place where we can host, you know, people who are dealing with cancer, people that have had cancer.
Where would that be?
We'll let you know. We're in the process of looking for it now. No. That's our project that we're working on right now. But instead of hosting so many talks, lectures, symposiums, gatherings, think tanks, financially, we'd like to find a place where we could host all this and bring the great minds in, give them a little bit of time together, and also let the public come in and interact and learn more, and also have fundraising events there.
You know, I've been by the Institute so many times in Santa Monica. How long has it been there?
We moved over there in, I believe, 91. It was at UCLA before that. Started at UCLA, and I think in the early 90s, my brother Michael made a deal with the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth, who owned that hospital, to move the Institute over there. And
St. John's.
Yeah, St. John's. And it has now been taken over by a great great operator, Providence. So they're a significant presence in our area and down south where I live in Orange County. So Providence runs that now.
Okay. And when's the next time you're going out on your dad's boat? Because it's still in the water.
It's still out there. It doesn't look like it did when he had it, but it's still out there and still floating, and I have a lot of terrific memories on that boat. Man.
I got to tell you, I mean, I was down there. I was doing some story on the water down there, and somebody said, hey, that's John Wayne's boat over there.
Yeah.
So it's known.
It's 136 feet. It's an old World War II minesweeper that was converted to pleasure use. And, you know, that thing would be up in southern Alaska and British Columbia in the summers, and then down in, Sea of Cortez or mainland Mexico in the winters. He went as far as, the Mediterranean and the Azores in it. And, as a place for our family to be able to spend time together, it was a terrific spot. My father loved the sea. We all grew up, on the ocean.
He was as much a sailor as a horseman?
Yeah, more so. The horses were for work, and he was obviously a terrific horseman. Watch him on a horse. He was an amazing guy. But his, where he liked to relax was on the ocean, and he loved Mexico. He was married to three Mexican women. My mother's from Peru, but the other...
Your mom is Pilar.
My mother's Pilar, yeah. So he loved that Latin lifestyle. And
Can you do an impersonation of your dad?
I don't think so, no.
No? You've had all these years to try to figure it out.
I stay away from that.
Well, Pilgrim.
He was very unique. He created that persona over many, many years, and he was very good at what he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's been gone for 40 years, and we still have a really significant following on social media, of all things, people who are still interested in John Wayne.
What do you think of that?
Well, I just think that, he had a value set where he taught you to respect the other person while still respecting yourself. And he did it with humor, and he did it with kindness. And that 90 minutes of entertainment that you got from a John Wayne film was very consistent. And I find myself today, I didn't come to John Wayne through the screen. I didn't meet him in the movie theater. He was my father. I grew up on the other side of that. But I understand now, if The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is on, or True Grits is on, or McClintock is on, I put it on and I go, gosh, let me just watch it for a minute. And then pretty soon, I've sat there through the whole film. For me, I enjoy the experience, and I understand the public's experience that they have with him. But for me, I also have the experience of spending a little time with my father.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's it like to watch your dad in a movie?
Well, it's great. He died when I was 17. It was, I was, I loved my father. I had a great life with him. I wasn't ready for him to go. I drove him to the hospital. I didn't think he wasn't coming out. So that was a little bit of a shock for me at that time. And then as you get older, you realize, it would have been great to have him around a few more years. But the films are, it's just, you get to look at him and you see, one, he's in his element, he's working, he loved stories, he loved sharing stories, he loved reading stories, he loved life on location, he loved interacting with all the, the craziness of a crew, because you have... you have tough old Wranglers, you have all, in the 60s we had just what a mix of people, men, women, gay, this, that, whatever. They were all there to work on a project. They respected each other. They were good at their jobs. They got the job done. You know, they worked well together, and he loved it.
Did he do a lot of his own stunts?
He did some. He and his stuntman were both, you know, getting older. And so I think my father could run better than Chuck, but Chuck would do all the other falls. So they'd, you know, they'd look at what had to be done, and they'd go like, you know, Chuck would be like, my knees are killing me. He's like, okay, I'll do the running, but you fall or go in the cold water or whatever it was. You know, he was, I mean, if I'm remembering and I'm 10 or 11 years old, then he's 66 or 7 because he was 56 when I was born. So, you know, this is a guy that's got one lung, you know, played football, a little beat up, had a, you know, good life, spent years doing B-Westerns, you know, falling down, getting up, getting in fights. He, you know, the movie business is tough. When he was doing it, he filmed out in Durango, Mexico. It's 6,000 or 7,000 feet high. It's 30 or 40 degrees in the morning. You're trying to catch that morning light. You're trying to catch the evening light. It's a great life, but it wasn't easy for him physically sometimes.
Did I read this correctly that you were an actor and until the business sort of consumed your time, but did you come in as a stunt person?
When my father died when I was 17, and there was a guy named Gary McLarty who I would go to motorcycle races with, and I'd reached out to him, and he was actually doing the Blues Brothers in Chicago, and he said, Ethan, do you want to work for me? And I said, you know, I'd love to. I was a little rudderless at that point, and he took me out there and put me to work, and when I came back, Gary Jensen, another stunt coordinator who I knew as a little boy, picked me up and put me to work, and I think they gave me a direction. So I'm eternally grateful to those guys for just trying to keep me on the right trail. And then, you know, as I did some of that stunt work, I got little acting parts, and I had a soap and a TV series and some other work that I did. So it's a great way to make a living if you can do it.
Well, I'm grateful that you were here to talk about all this. I mean, you come to the conversation with quite a lot of background, and some of it's very, very sad. I mean, it's sad to think about losing a parent. It's sad to think about somebody who you love dearly, and yet, you know, they have continued even in death to have an impact on other people's lives.
Huge impact on other people's lives, yeah. He was an amazing guy. He was a great dad. He was, you know, he was a movie star in the largest sense, but such a down-to-earth, kind, loving individual. It's a personality that's rare, you know, and was lucky to have him as a dad for as long as I did. You know, it's a positive experience for me. I don't look at it negatively. Sure, I'd love to have him around today to discuss some topics, but, you know, I'll be 57 on Friday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So he was 56 when I was born.
That puts it in perspective.
Yeah, it does.
Well, the great thing is you've got plenty of movies to remember your dad.
To go back to, yeah, I do. Thanks, Hal.
Good conversation. My thanks to Ethan Wayne and Keith Sterling and to you. Thanks for joining us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and give us a few of those stars, you know, and let us know what you think of our episodes of What the Hell.